Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 7, Further Inquiries by Vidura, Text 17. Translation. This is Vidura speaking to Maitreya. Both the lowest of fools and he who is transcendental to all intelligence enjoy happiness, whereas persons between them suffer the material pangs. Purport. The lowest of fools do not understand material miseries. They pass their lives merrily and do not inquire into the miseries of life. Such persons are almost on the level of animals, who, although in the eyes of superiors, are always miserable in life, are unaware of material distresses. A hog's life is degraded in its standard of happiness, which entails living in a filthy place, engaging in sex enjoyment at every opportune moment, and laboring hard in a struggle for existence. But this is unknown to the hog. Similarly, human beings who are unaware of the miseries of material existence and are happy in sex life and hard labor are the lowest of fools. Yet, because they have no sense of miseries, they supposedly enjoy so-called happiness. The other class of men, those who are liberated and are situated in the transcendental position above intelligence, are really happy and are called paramahansas. But persons who are neither like hogs and dogs, nor on the level of the paramahansas, feel the material pangs. And for them, inquiry about the supreme truth is necessary. The Vedanta Sutra states, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, now one should inquire about Brahma. This inquiry is necessary for those who are between the paramahansas and the fools who have forgotten the question of self-realization in the midst of life in sense gratification. Om agena chimadandasya genanjana shalaka chakshun meditam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nitananda shri advaita gadabha shri vasudhi go bhakta vrinda hare krishna 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 hare 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 ram 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 hare hare. Very interesting verse. Deep insight into the quest for happiness. Everyone wants to be happy. You all want to be happy. Everyone is profoundly affected by happiness and distress. That is the nature of conditioned life. We spoke about that previously. Shitoshna sukha dukkha. The happiness and distress comes and goes like the winter and summer season, and that coming and going is the story of our life. As much as we are not absorbed in the internal potency of the Lord, the Daivi Prakriti, as long as we're not absorbed in Krishna's service as a life and soul, we must be kicked by the happiness and distress of material existence. You want to be happy. The secret of bhakti yoga is you're happy not by thinking about your own happiness, but by thinking about Krishna's happiness. This is an art, a science, a culture, a skill. Indeed, it is our eternal constitutional position. Why does it seem to be a bit of a struggle to not worry about your own happiness and just think of Krishna's happiness? It's a struggle because we've forgotten Krishna. It's a struggle because of the intervention, the artificial intervention of the illusory energy and our proneness to be affected by the illusory energy. And therefore we become overwhelmed from time to time as devotees by bouts of, oh, what about me? Where is my happiness? How am I feeling? As if we are separate from Krishna. That is the root cause of the disease. Seeing ourselves to be separate from Krishna. Vidura has been questioning Maitreya Muni about the nature of the self and the nature of the Supreme Lord and the relationship between the two. Vidura is paving the way in this section of Bhagavatam so that we can actually understand what's our position in this world and how we're going to be happy. He's heard a convincing, comprehensive presentation from Maitreya Muni. And Maitreya Muni has lanced all his doubts, just like lance of oil. And so Vidura is expressing his gratitude. Gratitude, as we've spoken before, is an essential element in bhakti yoga. Anytime someone has helped you, inspired you in your spiritual life, to show gratitude is a devotional practice. And by that gratitude, you impel that person who helped you to feel encouraged to help others. And conversely, by the lack of gratitude, you can actually discourage someone from reaching out to help others. We've discussed how this happens. How does Vidura express his gratitude to Maitreya? Sanchana samseyo manyam tava sukta siddha vibho ubayachapi bhagavan manume sampratavati. O powerful sage, my lord, all my doubts about the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the living entities have now been removed by your convincing words. My mind is now perfectly entering into them. This is real hearing. Vidura is describing the laboratory experience. My mind is perfectly entering into your words. That's not a material thing. When the mind is perfectly entering into spiritual sound vibration, you are experiencing. Materially, often we don't understand how it is that one can learn just by hearing. It should be that experience teaches you. Hearing seems to be theoretical, superficial, insubstantial. But no, spiritual hearing is a better conveyor of experience than the material conception of experience, where you gotta jump into it. This is the power of spiritual sound, and Vidura is testifying about that. All my doubts have been removed by your convincing words. My mind is now perfectly entering into those words. Mano me sampratavati. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes the fire of transcendental knowledge burns. A fire is not a theoretical thing. Burning is not a theoretical thing. So when the mind is perfectly entering into the spiritual sound vibration, and the spiritual sound vibration is perfectly entering into the mind, you get experience in this way without the very painful material type of experience. You know the saying, experience is the best teacher. And everyone forgets the second half of the mantra, because a fool will learn no other way. Bhagavatam is not meant for fools, and Vidura is learning in the most intelligent way. My mind is perfectly entering into your words. This is a sensory experience that brings about Divya Gyan, the divine knowledge, awakening in the heart. Divya Gyan, Vidde Prakasito. You sing that at Guru Puja. The divine truths that you're imparting to me are manifesting in my heart. This is nothing theoretical, just like it's nothing theoretical that the fire of transcendental knowledge burns. By the processes of devotional service, particularly by hearing, you experience. This is indeed mystical. It happens. Don't think that because you're just hearing Bhagavatam that your life is going to be devoid of the experiences necessary to conquer over Maya. Sometimes it is thought that I've got to stick my fingers into the honey jar and that way I'll learn my lesson. An intelligent person doesn't learn that way. Of course, when the mode of passion is affecting the consciousness, then indeed you think, I've got to do things in order to learn. How can you expect otherwise? For many persons, it'll be like that. And indeed, the Krishna Conscious Society authorities has to have room for those kind of persons who have to stick their hands in the fire once, twice, three times, and getting tired of these birds. There'll be devotees like that, and we have to expect that and have room for them to gradually learn not to stick your hand in the fire. There'll also be devotees who can hear fire burns. Don't stick your flesh into the fire. Just by hearing that, they can, they're in spiritual intelligence because they've properly heard. Their spiritual intelligence can penetrate into the reality and understand. There'll be devotees like that too. Naturally, we would like that everyone learns by hearing. But we have to be practical with the way this world is and the power of illusory energy. So therefore, we want an association of devotees, a sangha, which doesn't discriminate against either group. In my travels around the world, I have noted that sometimes you'll see gatherings of devotees, communities of devotees that favor those who want to learn by experience. Well, you know, that's the way it is. You know, unless you're in Maya, you can never really understand Maya. Unless you get into it, you can't really understand how to get out of it. You've got to stick your fingers into the honey jar, you know, and realize the futility. And sometimes that kind of group of devotees will discriminate against those who want to learn by hearing. Oh, you guys will find out one day. You'll regret that you didn't try by experience. You may be blissful now, quoting Bhagavatam slokas now, but just wait 10 or 20 years. You're going to wish that you had stuck your hand in the fire and learned your lesson that way. In other words, the implication is that it's an inferior process to learn by hearing. Or if it's not an inferior process, it's just not suitable for us. Even though it's a superior process, we're inferior, and therefore we just got to. So, you go to other places, few and far between, albeit, and you'll find enclaves of devotees who are very strict and who adhere to all the devotional practices very strictly, carefully, and they have no tolerance for dealing with those who want to stick the hand in the fire. And after many decades of burnt flesh realize, actually, hands don't belong in the fire. So the strict ones, they don't have any compassion or flexibility, or they don't have the desire to deal with those who are not so fortunate. So in this way, one group can discriminate against the other. Those on the slow train, the slow and bumpy train, discriminating against those on the fast train, those on the fast train discriminating against those on the slow and bumpy train. But actually, we want to be a full service hospital, appealing to all kinds of patients. That is compassion. Not all patients are going to strictly follow the doctor's order and immediately get well. Some patients will follow the doctor's instructions for a while, get healthy, and then we've got to try a bit of disease right now. Just to be able to compare. And after experiencing disease again, they may again decide to listen to the doctor. You know, it's up, down, and all around. The overall purpose of the hospital has to be to cure persons. Sterilization against the germs. And that energy or direction for keeping the sterilization in place, keeping the germs out, that is the overriding influence in the hospital. And therefore, the hospital can stay properly situated in spite of wayward patients. Without that dynamic force generated by the hospital staff to keep things pure, the germs can overwhelm the hospital. Because it's the nature of spreading Krishna consciousness in the material world that you're going to be dealing with germs. So there has to be compassion. At the same time, there must be constant efforts at sterilization, purification, stabilization to keep the ship on course. This takes maturity. This takes intelligence. One has to learn how to draw the line without discouraging someone. How to point out what is the standard without being contemptuous or condescending to someone who's having a tough time. Pointing out the standard, pointing out the effects of not following the standard, that's mercy. But one has to learn how to give that mercy. And it may take some time to learn those skills, but one has to start somewhere. We don't want to marginalize anyone. The fast train folks or the slow and bumpy train folks. We want everyone to feel that they are loved and cared for. But in order to feel loved and cared for, one needs to understand the love and care comes in the form of guidance and support. It's not some kind of new agey, you know, warm fuzzies feel good. Love and care comes in the form of guidance and Krishna conscious support. Therefore, as we've spoken before, a devotee, whether he's or she's fast trained or slow and bumpy trained, if you just relish guidance, that's the most important thing. Relish guidance, relish support, relish inspiring sangha. So please think about this, Vidura's words. That I've heard the words of Maitreya Muni and I'm perfectly entering into those words. This is a yogic process, Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu. Remember we discussed about hearing the Hare Krishna mantra is the secret, not mental prowess for withdrawing the mind, but no. Surrendering to the sound vibration of the holy name as your only solace and shelter. Vidura goes on to explain. Sadveta vyahitam vidvan natma maya yunam hare. O learned sage, your explanations are very good. As they should be, or as I expected. Your words have done the job. And he shows, by giving feedback, by repeating the conclusion of what Maitreya Muni told him, he shows, I understand, I have assimilated. What's the conclusion? Disturbances to the conditioned soul have no other basis than the movement of the external energy of the Lord. Please think about that. Where did the disturbances in my life come from? Where did the disturbances in my mind and body come from? Where did the disturbances in society come from? In nature, in the environment, where does this all come from? The disturbances are the movement of the Lord's external energy. No other basis. The more we detach ourselves from the external energy, the less there are the disturbances. Meaning, the less we are affected by the disturbances that are always there in the material world. We're not rosy-eyed, thinking that they'll never be disturbances in the material world now that I've started to chant Hare Krishna. Now, Krishna promises you in Bhagavad Gita, you'll pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by his grace, with his help, with his guidance. So the obstacles will be there, the disturbances will be there, but you pass over them. What is harassing us? It's the external energy of the Lord. Is it Krishna's fault? No, we have misidentified that external energy. And therefore, we're getting the results to varying degrees. What about our happiness? Who can say they're not concerned with their own happiness? You don't want to be unhappy in Krishna consciousness. Yet, indeed, most devotees will say, well, why is it that sometimes we're not so blissful? Why is it that sometimes we do feel a struggle? Why is that? Isn't it so that when you take up Krishna consciousness, it's just a never-ending joyride? A garden of roses? That's what I want. I want relief from material distress. Yet sometimes I see that as a devotee, I undergo challenges. I go through a rough patch, maybe. My ship gets rocked by the waves. Srila Prabhupada once described how actually a devotee who's following properly is not truly affected by the modes of material nature. He said it's like being in a boat that's on the waves of the sea. The waves of material nature are rocking the boat, but they're actually not touching the devotee inside the boat. But if the devotee identifies with the external circumstances, the boat and the waves, he'll think that the waves are touching him or her. When actually the waves are just rocking the boat, and the person who is situated in the boat is untouched. So for a devotee who's properly situated in spiritual practice, actually the waves of material nature aren't touching you. But due to lack of realization, the lack of Krishna conscious experience, and most significantly due to a lack of guidance and spiritual support, the devotee may mistakenly identify, oh, just see, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I'm serving Krishna, what's happening to my mind, what's happening to my body, oh, it's too much. When actually the modes of material nature are just rocking the external situation. They're actually not affecting the devotee directly. Simply the devotee has to become more skillful, more knowledgeable, get some guidance to be able to distinguish between the person in the boat and the waves. That was Srila Prabhupada's point. You know, I think I've said before, later in the third canto, Lord Kapila Dev explains about devotional service and the various modes of material nature. Devotional service and goodness, passion and ignorance. So a devotee wants to ask Srila Prabhupada. This section spoken by Lord Kapila Dev about devotional service and the various modes, does it apply to your disciples? Prabhupada was walking alone on a morning walk. And when he heard the question, he suddenly stopped, planted his cane, dead silence. Everyone was wondering what comes next. And he looked at the devotee and said, who is my disciple? The devotee was shaking. And he came up with the answer, Prabhupada. A disciple is one who follows your instructions. So does that section spoken by Lord Kapila Dev about devotional services, modes of nature, does it apply to such a person, a real disciple? Again, silence. Probably again. No. And kept on walking. So, if we're conscious of the great wealth that we have in terms of devotional service, and we think about it, Think about service. Think about rendering service. Think about our motivations. Think about our appreciation of devotional service. Think about our gratitude for devotional service. Get into it with the heart, with the emotions, and with the intelligence. Not do some kind of religious, ritualistic, activity. But really get into it so that you become absorbed. That's why Kali Yuga can rattle your mind. What does Kali Yuga promise you with its nefarious activities? Absorption. A little bit of Rajagun will just envelop you completely and you'll feel wholesome. The bodily affairs of Kali Yuga denizens seem to provide an escape from having to deal with yourself. Just dive into the steam and you'll become enveloped. Enter into the sauna, into the steam room, turn the dial all the way up, and you'll just be in a world of your own. This is the promise of Kali Yuga. Absorption. Unless our immersion in devotional service exceeds our capacity to be absorbed in material energy, we're going to be shaken by the waves. I've often said, look at what you did in your pre-devotional days, the sacrifices you made, the absorption that you experienced, the absorption that you arranged for yourself. Look at that. You have to at least rival that in your devotional service. You have to at least give Krishna what you gave in material life. The tolerance that you underwent in order to achieve material goals. The absorbing experiences, devilish though they were. The intelligence you may have invested, the physical energy that you invested. You have to at least give that much effort in devotional service. Otherwise, you're plainly cheating Krishna. Hopefully, you'll give more, but you have to at least give Krishna an equal amount of absorption. And then you'll begin to experience the wonders of devotional service. It's embarrassing sometimes when we think how we hold back and give Krishna second and third best after we've given material life, the external energy, our best shot. I gave it our best energies. Sometimes out of frustration, we think, well, I gave all my all in all in material life, and now I've come to Krishna consciousness devastated, looking for relief. I don't think I can ever endeavor again. I don't think I can ever commit myself like the way I committed in material life. I just want relief in bhakti. I just want just to be... feel freedom from material distress. But freedom from material distress is not the goal of bhakti yoga. The goal of bhakti yoga is taking on the effort for Krishna's pleasure. That absorption is unrivaled. Now, Vidura is continuing revealing his assimilation of Maitreya Muni's words. Yascha mudatamo loke, yascha bude paramgataha, tavubo sukam etete, krishya yantaratojana. Very, very insightful statement about who can be happy in this world. You'll save yourself a lot of anxiety in pulling your sika or whatever ladies do when they're in anxiety. You'll save it just by understanding this insight. Who can be happy? See how you're situated. Which category do you go into? Are you in the mudatama category, the lowest of fools? The lowest of fools can be supposedly happy. So-called happiness. That's the Kali Yuga lifestyle. that's so prevalent now. And Srila Prabhupada very graphically describes that lifestyle in the purport, comparing it to a hog. Similarly, human beings who are unaware of the miseries of material existence and are happy in sex life and hard labor are the lowest of fools. Yet because they have no sense of miseries, they supposedly enjoy so-called happiness. So this is all that current society can offer you. So-called happiness in sex life and hard labor. That's it. There may be some other little ornamentation around those two main platforms of existence, but there's nothing else really other than those two things. All else is frills. Well, think about it. What's bugging you? This is all Kali Yuga has to offer. In that sense, actually, it's a benediction to live in Kali Yuga because everything is quite clear. There's no subtleties. You can't say, well, I'd like mystic powers and go to the heavenly planets. You can't live that kind of lifestyle in Kali Yuga. Even, I would like to live just a mode of goodness life without bhakti. You actually can't do that in Kali Yuga either. The circumstances are too agitating. The atmosphere is too polluted. This is not the Satya Yuga. It's not the Treta Yuga. It's not the Dwapara Yuga. In Kali Yuga, as the Germans say, alles klar. Everything is clear. There's no doubt about what's going on. There's no... there are no niceties. All that goes on in Kali Yuga is hard labor and gross sense gratification. That's it. Therefore, we have the four rules. By following those four rules, as you know, the pillars of the sinful palace are pulled out, and the whole Kali Yuga palace collapses. This is anartha nivritti for Kali Yuga. Srila Prabhupada would describe that. Anartha nivritti? No intoxication, no gambling, no eating, no illicit sex. In the 12th canon of Bhagavatam, it is said how great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga. Because they see with their spiritual sagacity, you can easily go back to God in Kali Yuga. And after such a short life, everything is clear in Kali Yuga. There are no niceties. There are no subtle distractions. Heavenly planets, by punya, pious activities, mystic powers. Kali Yuga, everything is barren, gross, and disgusting. Therefore, great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga because you can see clearly what's going on. No niceties. And after such a short life, you can go back to Godhead. Most importantly, in Kali Yuga, you can attain all perfection simply by chanting Hare Krishna. And it's explained earlier in Bhagavatam that we should have no doubts. The chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is an eternal process. It's available in all yugas. But in, for example, Satya Yuga, the people are so qualified and their lifespan is so long, they have a hard time understanding that they can go back to Godhead just by chanting Hare Krishna. Well, first, don't you have to get into samadhi for 60,000 years and then... they're so qualified. In Kali Yuga, there's no doubt. The deck is clear of most of the competition. You can't achieve success in life just by following Varnashram Dharma. You can't achieve success in life just by performing pious activities. You can't achieve success by mystic power. Life in Kali Yuga is a brutish, short struggle. 70 years on the average at most in developed countries. Remember, I told you how I was doing a university program in Cape Town, South Africa, and there were some students from Botswana there, and they were listening eagerly. One of them, one of the group, she's not from Botswana, she's from Botswana. She's in Melbourne now, Srupshakti Devidasi. So I invited the students, please come over, let's discuss more at our center. So they came in the evening. Before they came, I decided, let me get some information about Botswana. So I looked it up on the internet. And then I found out the average lifespan of a resident of Botswana is 32 years. So when the students came over, you know, we exchanged niceties and discussed a bit lightly. And I said, excuse me, but how old are you? 22, I'm 23. Do you know that according to the statistics of your country, you just have 10 more years to live? Yes, yes, we know. We know. So I said, it's extraordinarily imperative that you take this Krishna consciousness seriously. Look at your national average for the duration of your life. They knew it, but still, we're going to enjoy somehow. All right, you may say, oh, 32 years. Oh, that's really primitive. Those unfortunate parts of the world. I mean, we've got 70 years or so. How great is that? It's all just a blink of an eye, whether it's 32 or 70. I asked my mother, who's 82 now, I said, what's your realization now that you're 82? What do you think, looking back? She looked at me and said, it's amazing how quickly time passed. That was her number one realization. It all went so quickly. So what's so great about a lifespan of 70 or so years? The average in developed countries is the women live a few years longer than the men. The great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga because they say after such a puny lifespan, an eye blink in time, you can go back to Godhead just by chanting Hare Krishna. Let's look at the advantages of Kali Yuga. As we said, the monsters are out in the open. There's no doubt. No one here has any doubt what the monsters are walking around in Kali Yuga. You don't have to worry so much, oh, will I be attracted to mystic powers? Perhaps pious activity, digging wells, planting trees. Not this day and age. Practically speaking, it happens, but very rarely. You don't even have to worry, will I be attracted to monism? Merging into Brahman? These monsters are not so not so dominating in Kali Yuga. But in Kali Yuga, there's just a couple of huge monsters, and they're right out in the open in your face. There's no secrets, right? No secrets in Kali Yuga about what the monsters are. You don't have to go crawling through the underbrush. I wonder what's really causing the trouble. It's all out in the open. Therefore, great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga. Of course, they're great saints and sages because they know how to easily conquer the monsters of Kali Yuga. So looking at Kali Yuga from that advantageous position, they say, let's worship Kali Yuga. It's a dream come true simply by chanting Hare Krishna. You go back to Godhead after a short life. The happiness of the mudattamas, the ultimate fools. That's what Kali Yuga offers. Those kind of persons can seem to be happy. Let the good times roll. You know, hey, I feel all right. Those kind of persons can be happy in Kali Yuga, supposedly. That's animal life, though. The animal has no conception of its low-grade enjoyment. It's like if you walked outside and saw some forest creature slithering through the mud. You would feel pity for the creature. Similarly, the genuine yogis feel pity for those slithering in the mud of Kali Yuga. It's low-grade happiness. Have no doubt, the animals do taste the so-called pleasure of sense gratification. The same taste that humans get. We've explained that before. It's not that the human sense gratification is superior in taste. The taste is the same. I described to you how that was the first Krishna conscious precept, that knocked me over the head. Reading the transcendental teachings of Prahlad Maharaj, getting to that point on page 2 or 3, I just collapsed in a chair reading it. All this endeavor to get the same taste that any lowly creature gets. I was devastated. The next morning, I really decided I'm going to Greenwich Village, New York, getting more books by this Swami whose name I can't pronounce. I've never seen such an educational opportunity available like this. The first Sunday feast lecture I saw Srila Prabhupada gave a month after I moved in with devotees. Roaring on the Vyasa side. You might call it negative preaching now, though, so maybe I shouldn't tell you. You might say it's not really sensitive to the warm fuzzies and quasi-spiritual sensibilities of the people. What was the first thing I heard? Not the first thing, but he concluded his lecture, roaring, "If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal." Should you try this at a Krishna fest? When Srila Prabhupada says such things, you just are hit with the compassion. It's not like you're hit over the head with an iron bar. You're hit over the head with just heartfelt compassion. Like a most loving father trying to protect his children. If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. Only an animal is optimistic about material life. If you're a human being, you must be pessimistic. Oh, New Agers hate this. Sometimes we even get a few weak devotees who also hate it. Recently, I heard a few comments, you know, from devotees who were having some trouble and feeling attracted to the monsters, or at least one monster of Kali Yuga. And so naturally, when you want to embrace a Kali Yuga monster, you have to kind of disparage or belittle devotional goals, especially after belittle devotees, and that way you can kind of easily slip out the door and frolic with the monster. So, the trouble with devotees is they're just not positive. They're always talking about the miseries of material life. That's not how to attract people. The real way to attract people is just to show them how everything is beautiful, everything is inspiring, it's all divine. Especially the Kali Yuga monster that we want to frolic with. It's divine. She's divine. I've heard a little bit of this lately. If devotees would just change their approach and not talk about the material realities, which are actually kind of good in their own way, then their preaching would be successful. I wonder what such poor, struggling devotees, by their own choice of bringing problems upon themselves, what they would say if they were sitting here in front of Srila Prabhupada, the foremost devotee, roaring like that. If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. This lecture is not in the folio, unfortunately. You know, back then, the recording of Prabhupada's lectures was, I guess, sometimes it happens, sometimes it didn't, or often the recordings were lost. I remember in Los Angeles, 1976 or so. You see, we never thought Prabhupada would leave this world. Although Prabhupada was very strict about wanting his lectures recorded, devotees just were, they were so young, in their early 20s, late 20s at the most, and Prabhupada will always be here, will be here eternally with Prabhupada eternally. So, just one new devotee, newly initiated devotee. Newly initiated means 6 months. You could get initiated from Prabhupada after 6 months. So, he had the job of taking care of all the tapes that were sent in of Prabhupada's lectures. And a few from time to time would be released by something called Golden Avatar Productions. They would release a few tapes sporadically of Prabhupada's lectures. So, the devotee was in the same building as me at the BBT, so I asked him, his name was Disha. I said, Disha, these lectures are Prabhupada, they come out sporadically. Why is that? What's the process by which you get the lectures out? He said, you know what I do? Every few weeks, you know, when I feel inspired, I just go through all the tapes that have arrived from Prabhupada's travels around the world, all the tapes of his lectures, and I play them on, what do you call it, fast forward, and I just listen as they're going at high speed, fast forward. I listen if I hear any high-pitched sounds of laughter in the background. If I hear laughter in the background, those are the tapes that I release. That was a Siddhanta. I did notice. I said, you know, all the lectures that come out on tape, you know, they have, you know, lots of laughter always in the lectures, you know. And he revealed the secret. That's what I listen for. If I hear laughter, playing it fast forward, if I hear high pitched laughter in the background, that's the lecture. It's a good lecture, I know. But the good lectures are also when Prabhupada is roaring. If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. Now you have to be able to say that according to your realization and compassion. It's not that you get up on a high horse. Okay, I am a devotee now, and you are a non-devotee. You are optimistic about material life. You are an animal. You're right, but probably there are better ways that you could go about being right. One has to have compassion. Of course, it's true that sometimes even if you say these things with compassion, people may get upset. It would even happen to Srila Prabhupada. Still, we want to make sure we're not speaking Bhagavatam knowledge from a position of feeling we are superior now. All my life I was a loser. Now I take the Krishna consciousness and I'm on top now. I'm the topmost knowledge. The knowledge is topmost, but are we topmost? The process is topmost, but are we topmost? That humility always has to be there. So, Mudatama, the lowest of fools. You don't want to be in that category. What about the Paramahansas? Yes, we all love to be in the Paramahansa category. But you'll say, are we there yet? What can you do? The rank and file devotee will say, I'm not a Mudatama. I'm not absorbed in animal delights, nor am I a Paramahansa. So what's my position? Vidura is clarifying that here. Your position is, because you're in between, to some degree you suffer the material pangs. So what does this mean? Krishna consciousness, the bhakti process, isn't all that it was presented to you as? You mean you still suffer the material pangs? Even though you're performing devotional service? I thought you just take up the bhakti process and immediately overnight, presto, just like what you read in Nectar of Devotion. Immediately, suddenly, on the spot, someone becomes fully Krishna conscious. You read that in Chaitanya Charitamrita also. Those examples in Nectar Devotion show you what is possible in bhakti. They should be read in that way. They're showing you the topmost levels of achievement. It can happen. But, in other words, you shouldn't hold your breath. It can happen, the common example given that you can get an honorary PhD at the university. It's like our Dr. Chandidas, he has finished his PhD. And Sam Brahmachari, he's finishing his master's degree. So, should they just say, I don't have to labor, I don't have to struggle? Because I think Victoria University or Manchester University is going to give me an honorary degree. What do you think, Johnny? That's good. That chance, huh? It does happen, but he can't endeavor with that kind of mentality. In fact, he was being persecuted by his PhD advisors. Jump through this hoop. Jump through that hoop. Grovel. Move your tail this way, that way. If you want to achieve the supreme destination. So some people do get honorary degrees, but don't hold your breath. So Nectar Devotion is showing you such immediate attainments are possible. But best that you absorb yourself in the rules and regulations of devotional service. You'll be successful in that way. You're not being shortchanged. It's not that, well, I can't be a Paramahansa overnight, so what's the use? It is not a small thing to diligently follow the practice of bhakti. It is the most glorious thing. Ripe mango, unripe mango. Okay, some super mangoes get ripe overnight. Other mangoes, take a few weeks to ripen. But if the mango is properly situated and stays so, the mango will ripen. Do you understand? The mango will ripen. Just don't fall off the windowsill. So Vidura is giving you some very practical instruction about the reality of life in this world. Expect that due to whatever degree of identification with the material energy you have, expect to feel some pangs, material pangs. We've spoken before about Prabhupada's poetic use of this term, pang. Like a hunger pang. On a fast day, you feel this twinge in your stomach. Oh, I wish I could eat. Your stomach is empty, and this kind of pang shoots through it. So similarly, we can feel material desires in that way. Expect that to varying degrees. That's part of living in this world as a devotee. The varying degrees, the degrees will vary according to your absorption in devotional service. No need for a devotee to just become overwhelmed, intimidated. Was it here I spoke about how material energy intimidates, or was it in Chalapati? I gave a lecture in Chalapati. I have that on the website, Chani Das. Earlier this year. No, November.
Oh, no, I don't.
Okay. Yes. How to be not intimidated by illusory energy. It's the job of the illusory energy to intimidate you. Hey! To get in your face. Rattle you. Rattle your cage, so to speak. And you can just fall apart. Oh! Why is the material energy attacking me? I'm a devotee. I'm chanting Hare Krishna. I'm doing all the things. I talk to my mentor, according to the minimum that's required. Why am I being attacked? Oh, no. Maybe I should just give up. I never expected this, that I would have to face the challenge of the illusory energy. It's all there in Srimad Bhagavatam about how the illusory energy throws things at you, intimidates you. Like a high, like a bully in high school or college. Any of the men ever dealt with bullies before? You come to school tomorrow, I'm going to punch you in the face. Nandu, did you ever encounter bullies at school?
Yes, Mark.
It was intimidating, right?
Yes.
I remember as I was 12 years old, and I would never want to tell the fellow students in class, you know, what my grades were on report card, because they had the ethic that, you know, they were proud the more red ink that was on their report card. Red ink, you know, fail, you know, F for fail. So they would, you know, wait, they go around, you don't call them report cards here, do you? Probably it's all computerized scripts these days or something for grade school. What do they send home your marks to your parents? On what form? But it's computer printout, right? Well, back in those days before computers, it was a card, and the teacher, your main teacher, would put all your grades on it from the various other teachers. And if it was F, failing, it would be in red. Some of the, you know, the cool guys, you know, the cool guys never studied. Even though they were 13, you know, they were into parties, girls, sports like that, and they'd always make fun of the students who studied. So the cool guys, even Indian, they like it. Just see how degraded the bar has become. The cool guys would be running around with their report cards at the end of the term. Wow, look how much red I've got on my report card. They had a saying, "Red sails in the sunset." It was a popular song back then, "Red sails in the sunset." My report card is as red sails the sunset. And then they would find the good students. "Let me see your report card." "I don't have it." "Let me see it." "We know you study. We want to see your report card." "Well, I lost it. I don't have it." "We want to see your report card." And finally they would just, you know, forcefully take your report card out of your school bag, show it to all the other bullies. "Look at this!" You know, start using foul language. "A blankety blank queer!" "Look at this! Who does this guy think he is?" "We should beat him to pieces!" So, this is how the material energy works. "Who do you think you are?" "Trying to perform devotional service. Get real! He must be a freak, a queer. Go talk to some normal people in society. Ask them what they think about the Bhakti process." Here you are wearing your devotional cloth, the japa mala, bead bags, kunti mala around your neck, and this stripe down your forehead. And you think you're going to be happy in this way? This is intimidation. One has to learn how to deal with it. Just like, you know, in school, in grade school, you had to learn how to deal with the bullies. You learn not to walk in certain hallways where the bullies congregate, right, Nandu? Because they always hang out in a certain area, you know, their sangha is located in a particular part of the school. They hang out there, you know, smoking cigarettes, trash talking, you know. And certain kinds of girls are always hovering around, right? The girls who want to, you know, make themselves readily available, hang out around the bullies. So, you know, I don't go out, I don't exit the school that way. That's where, you know, the bullies are and their, you know, and their girls. So you learn how to handle yourself. You're walking down the street, you see the bullies up ahead, you just, you know, turn a corner. So we must learn how to handle intimidation by Maya and not fall to pieces just because, you know, the material energy tries to get in our face of it. I have to learn how to handle that. It's a part of growing up and maturing in bhakti. How to handle intimidation. Not that, oh, I'm being intimidated. Oh, no. Oh, what to do? I guess I'm finished. I'm being intimidated by Maya. I guess that's it for me. That's what the material energy would like you to think. And that's what bullies would like you to think. You can remember that you just fall on the ground and cry, oh, don't beat me. Oh, please. Mommy, mommy. Like we taught, they have bullies in Calcutta too? Really? The same. Even in India. We have to learn how to be mature. Maturation in bhakti means learn how to handle intimidation and not just fall over every time the illusory energy pokes you with one finger.
Oh, that's it for me. Oh.
This information by Vidura is very helpful, so you can position yourself properly on the road back to Godhead. All right, I'm not the lowest of fools, and I'm not the Paramahansa. So therefore, from time to time, I'm going to feel some material pangs, like when you're hungry on a fast day. From time to time, it'll be like that. As I increase my absorption in bhakti, those pangs will diminish. But I have to be practical. Due to my countless bursts of immersion in the material energy, I'm paying a bit of a price, so I'll feel some pangs from time to time. But the show goes on. The bhakti show goes on. The train's not derailed by a little bit of intimidation. You don't want to go back to being a mudatama, a Kali Yuga fool. You want to move forward. Yes, move forward to the perfect platform of devotional service. This is another point we should understand. The human form of life is meant for moving one direction or the other. It's a junction. It's not meant for standing still. You have to either make progress up or you'll go down. There's no plateau in the human form of life. It's meant for movement, one way or the other. Knowing that, you should sort yourself out. You can't tread water in the human form of life. You must go up, or you'll be dragged down. That's the way the system is arranged. Knowing that, you might as well generate energy to move forward. It's a junction. Just like when you're driving a car, you come to a junction or crossroads. Who would just stop their car in the middle of a junction? And no one would do that. I gotta go one way or the other. If you did that, driving a car full of devotees and just stopped in the middle of a junction, the devotees would start screaming at you, hey, either back up or move forward. You can't stay in the middle. We'll be hit from either side by cars. The human form of life is like that. You must move forward. Otherwise, you're dragged backwards. Now let's talk about society. What is the great accomplishment of human society today? There's already suffering because of ignorance. There's already suffering because of our forgetting Krishna. There's suffering because of misidentifying the body as a self. What is the great accomplishment of society today? They've increased the suffering that's already there. That's all. We give them credit where credit's due. In so many fancy technological ways, you have increased the suffering. And people have become mesmerized by the so-called progress. And therefore, they think taking to devotional activities is primitive, sentimental. Or like I felt before I took up devotional service. You know, this Krishna consciousness doing nothing to solve the problems of the world. Of course, I could say, well, perhaps I was just unknowingly following in parampara because Srila Prabhupada presented that argument in a much more eloquent way to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. Srila Prabhupada said, how can I preach the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu all over the world in the English-speaking countries? India is not respected. India is a colony of Britain. Until India gets independence, who will take Indians seriously? First, we should become independent. Then we can preach. Oh, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's reply. Krishna consciousness is so important, it can't wait for anything. Anything means anything. Can't wait. And what's the use of independence, so-called? Who is free from material nature? Wait till tonight when you see the multimedia presentation, Born to Love, about victimization by hormones. And you dare to say you're independent? When the man reaches 12 or 13, whatever, is happening earlier now because of the effects of society, the testosterone goes up tenfold, and you think you're independent? You know, the testosterone, what makes the voice deeper and puts hair on the chest, and there's some other things too. Tenfold. And you dare to think that you're independent. You'll also hear the inner secrets, the chemical realities of romance. Lord Vishuddev says, Pumsastiya mitini bhava metam, teomito hideya grantamam. Attraction between male and female is the basis of material existence. What happens when that attraction, you know, when a fire is lit? What happens? There's a chemical called dopamine that's released in the brain, which is as addictive as cocaine. So therefore, you know persons who are just hooked on hooking up. Because that's the first symptoms of falling in so-called love, the first symptoms of romance, when the dopamine starts to flow in the preliminary phases of the romance before things bust up, when the dopamine starts to flow, it's a pleasurable mental feeling and as addictive as cocaine. A chemical is actually released in the brain. So just see. There's other things going on also. We'll let you watch the presentation tonight. Where's the independence? Such chemical victimization is going on, and we think, oh, I'm choosing. The kind of society we're living in ignores all the big questions. It's considered very scientific to not deal with the big questions. I was speaking about this in Melbourne last week or more. If you ask, where did the laws of nature come from? The laws of nature as known to conventional scientists. They'll say that this is an irrational question. This is not a scientific question. It's a question that cannot be verified, analyzed by science. Therefore, it's not befitting that you ask such a question. As a scientist, you're having faith that the universe is rational and everything is regulated. And as a scientist, you're using your intelligence to uncover the hidden rationality and mathematical coherence of the universe. That's faith. How do you know the laws, the so-called laws of nature you've uncovered, apply to every aspect of the universe? You just read Srimad Bhagavatam and you find out. No. Different planets have different materialities, in effect, and the residents have various powers in terms of interacting with those realities. You find fragments of this Vedic knowledge even in Western religions. People like to talk about angels. It's not all fantasy. Persons with wings who sing sweetly, Kinnaraloka. It's all there in the Bhagavatam. Kinnaraloka, the residents have wings and sing very sweetly. But there's just a glimmer of that knowledge in Western religious traditions. New Agers also talk about angels. Such things exist. Serpentine entities who come up from lower realms and masquerade as human beings. UFO literature is full of all that. It's there in the Bhagavatam. The serpentine entities from the lower planetary systems can take human forms. It's there in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The serpentine entities from the lower planets who were fortunate, they came up to the Earth planet disguised as human beings and went to Puri to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then they went back and spread the Sankirtan movement in the lower planets. You heard, according to one devotee's memory, he asked Srila Prabhupada, where are you going to go next to spread the Sankirtan movement? And he claims that Prabhupada told him to the lower planetary system. So, there's so many extraordinary realities that don't surprise us all in terms of what goes on in this cosmos. But you ask an ordinary scientist, what's the origin of everything? You're not supposed to ask that. That's deemed outside of science. So in other words, what you have as a result is a society that simply focuses on the intermediates. No beginnings, no end. Now how can such a predicament be beneficial for a human being? You're just dealing with an intermediate phase. I don't know where things came from. I don't know where things are going. But right now, we got a situation. We're going to enjoy it. Does that make sense? Srila Prabhupada gave the example, like you're looking in the sky. You see an airplane up above. It happens here sometimes. You can see airplanes over. So do you think that airplane in the sky above, that's the reality? That's the scientific reality. Someone asked you, well, where? What airport did the plane take off from? That's an irrational question outside of science. Where's the airplane going? Again, another irrational question. Just look at the airplane. Do you realize that with these binoculars, this telescope that I have, I can see the markings on that airplane so clearly? I can tell you what kind of airplane it is. I can describe how the light is shining off the wings of the airplane. Yes, yes, yes. But where did the airplane originate from? What airport? That's an unscientific question. Just focus on what's up ahead. You see that airplane? Just see how our society is progressing in terms of dealing with the intermediate situation. That's what you should be proud of. Why trouble yourself about what airport the airplane took off from and where the airplane's going to land? Right now, just study the airplane overhead. Look, with my latest scientific instrument, I can count how many persons are on that plane. I have some measuring device, some gauge that goes beyond my limited vision. That gauge can detect the heat from the human bodies in the plane overhead, and it tells me accurately that there are 59 human beings there. In fact, now our science is so much more advanced. It can not only tell you how many humans are on the plane by sensing the heat, it can tell you how they're seated in the plane. There's no one sitting in the exit row seat. We can tell that. Isn't this glorious? Just see how advanced we are. How wonderful human society has become. Please, I would just like to know what airport did the plane take off from. This is not a scientific question. It cannot fit in the laboratory process. So therefore, there's no point in your asking it. It's a waste of time. And where is the airplane going? Again, why do you ask those questions? In fact, by your asking those kind of questions, you are detracting from the well-being of human society. There are people suffering. There are people who don't have technological conveniences. And here you are asking, where did the plane originate from? When the plane is right up overhead in the sky, just focus on that and the people will be saved. And go on funding us, we scientists. Go on funding us. You religionists, especially you Hare Krishnas, are the worst. You're always talking about the ultimate issues that has nothing to do with the welfare of the people. An intelligent human being just focuses on that intermediate phase, the plane overhead in the sky, and you make this world a better place just by meditating in that way. But you people always want to take things to ludicrous extremes. What's the origin of everything? What does it matter? Things are here. Use them. Enjoy them. Dominate them. Isn't that what it's all about? Of course, be a gentleman or a lady in the process, no doubt. But But still, the goal is clear. Go for it. That's the reality. We don't agree with this kind of society. There's no way we can agree with this kind of society. We want to know what's the ultimate plan. Now there's global economic meltdown. Who knows what the result will be? So the people are wanting to know from the leaders, what's the plan? What's the plan? So the economy will get going again. Stimulus package. So the economy will get going and we can enjoy again. We want our leaders to wave the magic wand and the money starts to flow again for everyone. We don't agree with this kind of society. We want to show that real progress is spiritual progress, comprehensive knowledge of Bhagavad Dharma, the science of the Supreme. Live simply, save time for Krishna consciousness. Now there's so many studies indicating that economic prosperity doesn't automatically lead to happiness. People know that more and more. But what are they going to do about this knowledge? That they don't know. Okay, you can't be happy by just earning more and more money. Okay, what are we supposed to do? If you can't do that, should we just shoot ourselves? We've got to do something. Since we don't know what else to do, then I guess we should just go on making money somehow or other. Even in tough times, because there's no other way. Even though trying to make more and more money doesn't make you happy. They have no other knowledge of mode of activity. Actually, what we want to show the world is the bliss of a no-growth society in terms of economics. That's shocking. No economic growth. Sam and I were discussing that. That'll be our next arena of investigation. We want to be the cutting edge. It's already kind of old hat amongst educated people that there's no direct correlation between economic prosperity and happiness. That science is well validated. Statistics have been around for maybe 10 years now. We want to jump ahead of the current wave and say, since it's obvious increased wealth doesn't make you happy, and look at all the problems we have now in the global economic meltdown, isn't it possible to have a society in which no economic growth is acceptable? As people put their energies into spiritual growth. So please understand, we don't accept society as it is now. We don't accept that society to be beneficial. We accept it to be extraordinarily destructive. And there's no way we can water down that truth. Especially when you see people's opportunities and chances for spiritual development are being destroyed by such a deceptively progressive society. So we're not getting into a whole cynical, negative state of mind about it. No, we are looking at people's opportunities to make the best of the human form of life. Seeing that opportunity destroyed, we criticize. That's the point. It's out of love. It's out of compassion. Just like if you had to send your child to school every day, and every day on the road to the school, the child would be beat up. You would wonder, what kind of society is this? The mother, out of love and affection, would be crying out, what's become of the world? What's become of the neighborhood I live in? Every day my poor child walks to school and he's beat up. I can't do anything about it. I don't have enough money to move. I can't put my child in another school. I'm trapped. Oh. It's out of affection and love that the mother says these things. Well, similarly, our describing the realities of society today is based on affection and love and compassion. No gentleman or lady can just stand by idly and watch someone shoot, you know, put a gun to the head and shoot themselves. Does happen, but no gentleman or lady could watch that. We used to have some years ago, this video, actual footage of, and maybe Ram Dass remembers, of a person in New York City jumping, coming out on the window of like a seven-story apartment building. The person wanted to commit suicide and was threatening to jump. And the crowd was waiting down below. It was lunchtime in the center city. And so the person was just hanging out the seventh floor window, just at that final moment, should I jump, should I not? Should I jump, should I not? And what are the New Yorkers down below saying? Come on, jump, jump, hurry up, I've got to get back to the office, get it over with, jump, 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 come on, come on. You have to have lived in New York to understand that. Come on, hurry up, you know, on with the show. You know, my boss is calling me on my mobile. I gotta get hurry. We hurry up and do it so I can see it and then go. The police had a brilliant idea. They figured the guy was in distress because his wife was leaving him. So they went and found the wife and they brought her up to the window right next to him. And, you know, the police were begging her, please tell him it's all right, don't jump. So she stuck her head out of the window, you know, looked at the guy looked at her, he jumped. That was it. So what kind of person would be waiting down below watching? Hurry up, let's do it. It's very hard-hearted, callous. Devotees can't be like that. We see the way society is. We want to help people. The more that a society is favorable for spiritual development, the more credit we give to that society. That's the way it works. We want an actual human society. So please remember these words from Vidura. How everyone in between the super full category and the Paramahansa stage, they have to feel a few pangs from time to time. Just make further progress. Use the pangs to propel you forward. Don't get intimidated and befuddled. Oh, why is this happening to me? After 15 years, I feel a pang. Oh. You're in the material atmosphere. Pangs will come from time to time. Make further progress. Use the pangs to propel you forward. All right, I'm going to get closer to Krishna. I'm going to get more absorbed in devotional service. You have to know how to fight back. Have a sense of sporting. Have a sense of sport about it. Maya slugs you one time, you slug back three times. It's a sense of sport, you know? The material energy gets in your face and, you know, shakes her finger. All right. I'm just going to do some more chanting, do some more reading, engage in devotional service in a more heartfelt way. You know, the empire strikes back. Actually starts to get fun after a while. Believe it or not, it becomes fun. In that way, ultimately, as you near the higher stages of bhakti, believe it or not, Maya becomes your friend. What? Yes, Maya becomes your friend. Why? Because every time Maya attacks you, you run quicker back to Godhead. That's a friend that's chasing you back home. It's like you're taking a walk out here, and all of a sudden, let's say you're coming to the temple here, where a place where we have our activities. One day we'll have a temple here. Not exactly in this spot, probably, but up the road. So, yeah, you're walking along the road, trying to get to the program here on time. You're a little late, and all of a sudden some neighbor's dog starts running after you, nipping at your heels. You're going to... Yeah, I really actually wanted to get to the program earlier. You're going to move faster down the street. The dog is barking, biting at your heels. The end result is you got to the program on time. You got there even earlier. Similarly, in the higher stages of bhakti, you recognize Maya is actually doing a friendly thing. The intimidation is making you run quicker to Krishna. So this is the nature of development in bhakti yoga. It will happen if the mango stays on the windowsill and allows itself to get ripe in the sun. Don't fall off the windowsill. That terrifying intimidation by the illusory energy can actually become your friend. It drives you to Krishna quicker.